The old adage about April showers and May flowers doesn't apply when there's too much rain. Today, new research about how excessive rainfall can be just as damaging as drought. Plus, the website TurboTax promised the IRS that lower-income earners could file for free. But the company has kept users away from its free version on purpose. And after a recent decision by the Methodist Church to uphold restrictions on LGBT clergy, today we speak with ministers across Illinois about how their congregations are reacting.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, are you tired of all of this rainy weather? Well, when the rainfall gets too much, it actually turns out excessive water can be just as destructive to crops as drought. We're going to talk to an Illinois scientist about this new research, and we'll also learn about one of the most successful citizen scientist experiments in the world that's helping farmers and others protect migrating birds. But first, earlier this year, leaders from the United Methodist Church made the decision to uphold restrictions on LGBT clergy in same-sex marriage, and the result is a deep divide between a desire to maintain traditional church rules and a desire to be welcoming and inclusive. The vote to pass what's being called the, quote, traditional plan first took place in February in St. Louis, and just last week, a special judicial council met in Evanston to uphold this plan. And these statements of faith about the gay community are ones that impact more than 12 million people across the world. We're talking about the largest denomination of mainline Protestants. I'm joined now by leaders from a number of United Methodist churches across Illinois. From the Bloomington Normal area is Pastor Sarah Isbell. She was a delegate at the General Conference and preaches at Wesley United Methodist, the largest Methodist church in Bloomington. Jenny Bertrand is the pastor of Hope United Methodist, also in Bloomington. Jane Easley is a senior pastor at Christ United Methodist in Rockford, and Reverend Chris Winkler is on the line with us from Barrington Church. All of you, thank you for coming and joining us this morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Reverend Sarah, I wonder if we can start with you. As I mentioned, you were a delegate at the General Conference that met earlier this year. Can you just explain how this conference works? Is this an annual gathering?
Absolutely. So the United Methodist Church is actually a global body. We exist not in just in the United States, but in several different places around the world. And we gather every 4 years for what's called General Conference. General Conference is the body that makes all the decisions about how we function together as a church. We revise and talk about our Book of Discipline, which is the governing document over our behavior and our policies. So the General Conference meets as a global decision-making body, legislative body, every 4 years. We are typically on the same schedule as the United States presidential election, if that gives you a point of reference. But this particular conference that was held in February was off schedule because we were dealing with just this single issue of the church's response to human sexuality and what that means for us as a denomination. We had met, really, we've dealt with these issues every 4 years at every General Conference since 1972. But in 2016, at the General Conference session held in Portland, the issue just got to be sort of too big for the conference, so to speak, and just about shut down our proceedings. And so we agreed together as a global body to defer all legislation related to issues of human sexuality to a special called session, to a special commission and a special called session, and that's what happened in February.
And what particularly, so everything was discussed in this session, what exactly was voted on? What is in the traditional plan?
So the traditional plan was one of several plans put forward by a group called the Way Forward Commission. The Way Forward Commission was established by the bishops after the 2016 conference in Portland, and their job was to try to help help the church find a way forward, help the church find a way through this impasse regarding issues of human sexuality. So the commission, which represented people from all around the connection, different ages, different races, ethnicities, as well as gender, sexual orientation, came up with three possible sketches for the way that the church might move forward. And the one that passed at this conference was the one known as the traditional plan, which was designed, at least by those who favored it, to uphold those traditions, the traditional teachings of the church regarding marriage and ordination. The plan, in some sense, has been seen as not all that different from what we had before, in the sense that we went into this conference with understandings from the Book of Discipline regarding and regulating marriage, same-sex marriage, as well as ordination of LGBTQ persons, and we came out with those same restrictions upheld. For others, what was voted on does not seem like a continuation or really very traditional at all, because in the process of upholding those policies, we've implemented quite a bit of accountability language, which is to say punitive language, for those who disagree, for those who feel differently and wish to minister in a different way. And so for others, for many people, the outcome of this general conference didn't feel like upholding or maintaining as much as kind of a radical change within the denomination.
Sarah, let me just ask you one quick question. Was also part of this upholding also saying that being practicing, if your sexuality was something different other than heterosexuality, that it's a sin?
So the language of the legislation that we adopted doesn't use that language. It doesn't really talk about people, interestingly, as much as it talks about how the church will respond to them. So what was regulated primarily is how we go about deciding issues of who can and cannot be married, who can and cannot be ordained. But we really didn't talk about sin, per se. We talked more about those practices.
Okay, so that's Reverend Sarah Isbell. She's a pastor at Wesley United Methodist in Bloomington. We've got a couple of other ministers with us. I wonder if Jane Easley is also with us from Christ United Methodist in Rockford. Jane, what was your reaction to all of the energy? You weren't at conference, but when this news came out, what did you think?
I was heartbroken. I was really hoping that a different plan that would change the language would go through. I am one of many clergy, particularly in Northern Illinois and in many other places, who would promote the removal of the restrictive language and a full welcome for LGBTQ persons. So I was just heartbroken that it went through. The congregational response here at Christ in Rockford was more varied. There were people in the congregation who really didn't understand that these were the United Methodist policies, heard about it on the mainline media, and were quite upset and came to me and said, "What? You know, these are the United Methodist stances?" And I said, "Yes, they are. Your clergy don't believe in them, but those are the official policies." So it's actually engendered a really good set of conversations around what we do believe as a church. But it's also been extremely upsetting, particularly for those who have worked actively for full inclusion.
And when we think about that, Jenny, when I ask you about your congregation, you're also in Bloomington with Hope United Methodist. Can you tell us a little bit about your church?
Sure, thank you. We're only 5 years old, and from the very beginning, when I was invited to launch a church from scratch, I made it clear to my then bishop that it would be a fully inclusive church for LGBTQ plus people. That's the only way I would invest the energy in building a church. And we have actually, believe it or not, grown about 25% since February 26th, the end of this general conference, because we've made it clear that we will continue to be a place of full inclusion, and that we will be a part of the resistance, even down in south of I-80 in Illinois, in the cornfields, that we also fully believe in an inclusive church and will fight and work for that for all people.
And Jenny, I know you even have weekly theological conversations at a local gay bar in Bloomington. I wonder, if you're thinking about you saying you want to be part of the resistance, does that mean, and I should tell you guys, as a Presbyterian, I'm very familiar of how this happened in the Presbyterian Church 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, there were some pretty nasty legal battles that happened for people who went against what the church planned. I mean, is that something, Jenny, you're willing to go through?
I pray that that's not something that I need to go through. We do have a close relationship with the Bistro, which is sacred space in Bloomington Normal. It is a space where all people can be fully who they are. And we have built, and we honor that this is a very special relationship that the Bistro trusts Hope Church and trusts us in their space, and even sends people to our worship space. So last night in Pint Theology, which gathered at the Bistro, one of our 21-year-olds who would say that he plans to be an ordained United Methodist pastor. He identifies as gay, and he said, hope is a place of second chances. And he said, hold on, I don't mean second chances for people. I mean, it's a place where people who have been harmed by the church are willing to give the church a second chance, willing to give worship a second chance, willing to give God and their the depth of their faith a second chance.
I want to talk to all of you about how your congregations are doing, but Pastor Chris Winkler is also with us. Reverend Chris, you're Barrington Church. You used to be Barrington United Methodist Church. Why did you make that decision to change your name?
Well, it's not an official, legal decision. What we're doing is we are emphasizing the things about the church that we don't find a ring of the offensiveness of the traditional plan decision that was upheld by the Judicial Council. We're using other descriptors for ourselves because I think United Methodist right now is a damaged brand. And so we're just downplaying that affiliation. I think that's the answer to your question, Nyla.
I mean, I wonder, that must be, I mean, you're ordained in the Methodist Church, right? I mean, imagine that's a tough decision for you to make personally too, right?
Oh, I'm the grandson, nephew, and son of United Methodist pastors. So on a personal level and for the long time Methodists in this church, United Methodists in this church, it's been very challenging. But we've gotten widespread support too. Folks here are not happy with the decision and don't see a future for a church that is openly hostile to such a large segment of the population.
So I wonder, Reverend Sarah, if Pastor Sarah, if you feel like this does mean, because I'm sure there are people who don't think that this means that the church is openly hostile. But I wonder how you're handling people who do think that this stance is something that's hostile.
Right. So in our congregation, I imagine this is true for many congregations, we have a mix of perspectives. We have people who were relieved by the outcome of the general conference, and we have people who are devastated by the outcome of the conference, and sort of every place in between. And so what we're kind of doing at Wesley is focusing on our relationships, focusing on people over politics, or you could say relationships over regulations. If we can, rather than turning away from each other because we maybe disagree or hold differing opinions, if we can instead lean in towards each other and begin to just embrace the wounded, whoever they are. Maybe the people who are the most wounded are our LGBTQ plus persons and their friends and family. But I think people who lean right or more traditionally, they're sort of wounded too, because there's a hurt across the denomination now. And so what I'm kind of encouraging my folks to do is I've said to them, run toward the wounded. Whoever the wounded are, run toward them and put your arms around them and let them know that they're welcome.
and that the church is a place, the table is a place that's open to everybody. So that's kind of our focus right now, is to focus on holding each other through this difficult time.
Sarah, when you mentioned the diversity of perspective in your congregation, was that true as well for the vote at General Conference or at this special conference? Was that also, was the vote pretty divided, or how did the vote go?
Yeah, the vote was divided. I don't have the numbers memorized. I probably should, but there was only a 54-person difference between those who voted for and those who voted against the traditional plan. So I think that reflects really quite a divide across the denomination. It really wasn't sort of a windswept one side over the other. We really are very divided. And some of that's cultural, some of that's geographical, some of that's political or social, and a lot of it is theological as well. But yeah, the vote in that sense was pretty close.
Okay. I wonder if I can just, before we take a break here, I wonder if I can just ask a couple of you. Jenny, maybe we can start with you. I mean, as you're thinking about how you feel like you can, as Sarah's talking about bridging divides and bridging gaps, Jenny, is that something you feel like you need to be doing at Hope?
It's Sarah and I are in very different congregations. We aren't that far apart, and she and I are very close friends. However, my congregation is filled. Her congregation is 100 plus years old. My congregation is 5 years old and filled with people who had been previously harmed by the church and had decided they were never going to go back to church again. And then we take it as an honor that they trusted, that everyone who's come to Hope trusted to come back to church, to trust God again, to trust the church again. And so I see it as my responsibility to care deeply for my LGBTQ plus people and for them to care deeply for me. And I am not in a place of needing to bridge a divide between those who do not believe my LGBTQ people are created by God in the image of God, and behold, it is very good. That's just not my calling right now. My calling is to offer care, love, support, discipleship, leadership with
Jenny. I'm gonna have to I'm gonna have to stop you there just because we're gonna take a break, but we'll pick up this conversation just after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Tuning into The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we are talking about the United Methodist Church's recent decision to uphold restrictions on LGBT clergy and same-sex marriage. We're talking about that with a couple of ministers, Methodist ministers from all across Illinois, from Rockford, from Bloomington, from Barrington. And we appreciate all the comments we're getting from you guys on Twitter. Kudos to Reverend Chris Winkler for standing for his LGBT congregants instead of trying to thread an unthreadable needle is one of the comments we've got. We've also got a caller who is joining us now. Kim is on the line from Champaign. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was calling because I grew up in the Methodist Church and am supportive of the queer community. But one of the things that I heard when discussing this issue with my mom, who my parents are involved in the United Methodist community, is that there are sister churches in other countries who were started by the United Methodist Churches, and if we were to have it across the board as, I don't know, legalizing this or saying this, that this is the stance, that they could be killed because it actually goes against the laws that are in their country. And I think what I've heard is that that's one of the reasons why this has been such a difficult decision. And so if that is true, indeed, then can we discuss that and how we can go... How do we answer that? How do we go about that?
Pastor Sarah, let me ask you about that one first, and then we can see if other folks want to weigh in.
Sure. Kim, thank you for your question.
That's one of the really difficult things about all of this for us as we went to General Conference is understanding that different cultures and societies have different rules about that. And Kim, we understood, as you have come to understand, that there are places, particularly in Africa, where to be a gay person, an LGBTQ person, a homosexual person, is in itself illegal. And so persons who want to live out that identity and to be themselves are in danger of punishment and in some cases death. So as we come to understand that and look at, well, what is it going to take then to have a vote that brings us all toward a greater inclusion when inclusion for some means danger for others, that's led us down some interesting paths towards options that might involve maybe separating the United States, United Methodist Church, from the United Methodist Church in other countries, for example. Are there ways in which we can operate under different rules that are culturally appropriate for the context in which we're living? And so that's sort of where we are now, having passed the traditional plan and trying to look forward. Are there ways in which the United Methodist Church can be set apart contextually, culturally, so that everybody is safe ministering in the way that seems faithful to them?
Pastor Jane, I wonder, do you have any thoughts on that?
On that one, not as much. I'll defer to others.
Okay. Reverend Chris?
Well, one of the things that's been interesting in this is I think about 66% of the United States delegates to General Conference, somewhere between 66 and 70%, the numbers seem to indicate, were against the traditional plan. And the reason the traditional plan passed is because it relied on delegates from what we call the Central Conferences, which are Africa, the Philippines, and other places where these issues of legality and where people of LGBTQ orientation are really at risk, and those are real issues. I don't want to downplay those at all, but it's also been part of a political strategy from a group of folks to over these 20 plus years that we've been fighting about this, to increase the representation from the Central Conference countries for the purpose of ensuring that the vote would turn out the way it did. Those same people have resisted creating structures in the church, books of discipline for countries in Africa that would be perhaps different than those in the United States, as Sarah alluded to. So it's a little bit of it is a complicated issue.
I mean, I think there's a lot of complications here. This is obviously a complex issue. Pastor Jane, I wonder if I can. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I want to make one point that I think is important, Barrington Church is very representative of this. By no means is this church in the suburbs of Chicago, in one of the wealthiest areas, it is by no means a uber-liberal progressive church. It's actually quite moderate conservative is the way that I would describe it.
Well, it's kind of like Barrington, right? I mean, because no one thinks that Barrington is a particularly liberal suburb of Chicago, I don't think.
Right. But there's a difference between being a traditional and being a traditional non-compatibilist. And I think that's really important for folks who are listening to this to know.
Yeah, what do you mean
Barrington,
by that?
So Barrington, for example, has a number of people who hold very traditional views around scripture, orthodoxy, theology, but they do not believe that they can't live in a church where LGBTQ people can find their full expression. That's not a game breaker for them. And it's a relatively small group of people who built a political coalition who are the traditional non-compatibles. They are not do not see themselves as compatible in the same church with other with LGBTQ folks.
Okay. So I wonder if I can ask Jane Easley, who's with us from Christ United Methodist Church in Rockford, what would happen to someone if a clergy were to perform a same-sex marriage?
the performing of the same-sex marriage itself doesn't cause any repercussions. The repercussions would come if someone decided to press charges against that clergy person. So it is happening now that United Methodist clergy perform same-sex marriages. It just, in most cases, there is no one pressing charges against it. Prior to the special general conference, if someone officiated a same-sex marriage, if someone then pressed charges, a trial, the bishop would work with that, with the charges, try to resolve it without it having going to a trial court. It could then go to a trial court. There was a whole process that was undergone, generally trying to avoid any kind of religious court process. The challenge now is that the traditionalist plan, which was upheld by the Judicial Council, includes specific penalties. So no longer could the penalties for charges, if they were pressed, be handled in a more local manner, as I understand it, but now there'd be, and this is what happens if you officiate a same-sex marriage. So it isn't as if these aren't happening now. They are happening now. It just depends on what happens if charges are pressed.
And who can press those charges, Jane?
Anyone.
Anyone.
Yeah, it's not dependent on, so in other words.
And it's not dependent on geographic location either.
Right. For example, there was a period of time that a retired pastor in the New York Annual Conference would troll the New York Times for engagement announcements and wedding announcements. And when he saw that a wedding had been officiated by a United Methodist clergy person, he would press charges.
Mm.
So he made that kind of his personal mission to press charges.
Yeah. So I just want to end by asking all of you guys where you go from here, both as you've all shared your perspectives on this, as well as how you've shared how your congregations are handling this. I wonder, Sarah, if we can start with you.
Sure. Well, there's all different levels, right, about how we deal with it. So, you know, how do we deal with it personally, with our friends, with our loved ones, with our family members who are affected by this decision? And again, for me, the answer is run toward the wounded and comfort them and reassure them that there is a place in the church and in God's kingdom for them. There's the level of the local church. How do we care for each other? How do we focus on relationships and healing? There's the level of the annual conference. How do we work together as an annual conference to be represented at the general church level? At the general church level, how do we organize ourselves so that we can have a better representation in the next conference outcome of how the church believes or how we feel or what we believe to be the good news for people in this world?
Mm. Jane?
I would echo what Sarah has said. We also are doing educational work within the congregation. The congregation that I serve has not had as strong a United Methodist identity, so in a certain sense we're playing catch-up, helping people learn what the policies have been and having really substantive conversations about why those policies are what they are and then what we believe personally and as a congregation. I'm also part of a group of clergy in Northern Illinois, and Chris is part of it as well, that is in conversation about next steps. Will there be local churches choosing to leave the denomination? Will there be actions we would take as the Northern Illinois Annual Conference? It's a time of great flux, and I'm trying to be prayerful and stay in touch with a lot of different people while also offering opportunities for education and care in the local church.
Chris, is this something you would consider with Barrington Church, perhaps even leaving the denomination?
We're having discussions. We formed a task force of about a way forward for Barrington Church that also is paying careful attention to what's happening in the local denomination. The conversation that Jane and I are a part of with the pastors in Northern Illinois will be attending the UMC Next conference in later this month in Kansas City. I think there's the opportunity or the possibility of forming a new Methodist expression is very strong. The possibility of staying and fighting, I personally believe, is a little less likely as a successful outcome. But we're looking at all of those and keeping prayerful consideration. And Sarah's right. I mean, ultimately, church happens at the local level. And so the first and foremost is caring for one another. And so we're trying to have our task force pay attention to what's happening with these possible iterations of the Methodist Church. while the rest of us sort of stay home and do church the best we can.
Jenny, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you to that last point. You're planning on Hope United Methodist Church staying in. You mentioned earlier about the whole idea of people being hurt in the LGBT community about the church's stance. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I believe our entire congregation was hurt, and we have transformed that pain into action. And we want to be, we would be very excited and hopeful for a fresh expression of Methodism where all people are honored in living fully into the church. And we feel like where we are in Central Illinois, that our voice and our presence is important, but we will also continue to discern at what, if there's a point we need to make a different decision.
Well, all of you, Reverends Jane, Sarah, Jenny, Chris, thank you for taking the time to speak with us about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be with y'all.
It's the first day of May here in Urbana. It is all showers. There are no flowers. In fact, we could see rain on and off for the next week. I know that's the forecast for a lot of the state. And although precipitation can be a nuisance for some, successful farming season depends on some rain, especially if you're aiming to get your corn knee-high by the 4th of July. But a new study from the University of Illinois has found it's possible to have too much of a good thing. Researchers say excessive rainfall can be just as damaging to crops as drought. Evan De Lucia is one of the co-authors of the study. He's the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment at the U of I. Hi, Evan. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla.
Joe Zumwalt is also on the line with us. He farms about 4,000 acres of corn and soybeans along the Mississippi River between Warsaw and Quincy. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us as well.
You're quite welcome. Glad to be with you.
So, Joe, you're in Hancock County, which is kind of, as I was mentioning, pretty close to the Mississippi. Can you tell us a little bit more about your farm?
Yep, absolutely. We are on the very western side of Illinois, as far west in Illinois as you can get. And we are in between Quincy, Illinois, and Keokuk, Iowa. So right off the southeast tip of Iowa. And our farm lies almost entirely in the Mississippi River bottoms in a levied drainage district that borders the Mississippi River.
And when you say Mississippi River bottoms, what do you mean by that, Joe?
That's just what we would call the floodplain of the Mississippi.
Okay.
That stretches, you know, from the very tip of Minnesota all the way to the Delta.
And so do you have problems with flooding, Joe?
We have in years past, and we are beginning to deal with it this year. Like I said, our drainage district is levied, and our levee protects us when the river gets up to about 26 to 27 feet. And right now, our forecast with the rains that we've had are going to take us to about 25 feet.
So oh, boy. That's pretty close.
It is pretty close. It's kind of the edge of nervousness there, I guess you'd say. I mean, we're all kind of taking it in stride. There's things you do to prepare and get ready for that. But we're right on the edge of nervousness, I guess, for the next week.
And Joe, can you remind us non-farm folks, like what this time of year means for you in terms of getting your fields ready, when you plant, what it would be like? I mean, I imagine there's no time that's a good time for flooding, but what's this year?
That's right. I mean, to start this year, we kind of have to start with last fall. Of course, we had a very wet last October. The winter was pretty wet. Our river has been up, not to this level, but pretty much ever since last October. It's been at an elevated level. And so going into spring, when your river's already at a little bit higher level, like normally we go through winter and our river is 9 or 10 feet. This year, it spent most of the time right around flood stage at 15 or 16 feet. So what that means is when you get these spring rains, your river is already, you know, just has that much less capacity to handle the spring rains that we typically get. We have been lucky enough. We've been a little bit on the drier side of things around the state in the fact that we've gotten a fair amount of crop planted in our immediate area here in the last 2 weeks. But then here just in the last few days, we've received some of these heavy rains like the rest of the state, and along with northern Illinois and northern Iowa and the massive snow melts that they've been having. So that is all melting and running off and running by our farm. Currently outside the levee, and we hope it stays there.
All right. Well, we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out about excessive rainfall and Evan's research and think about, learn a little bit more about what he's been looking into for farmers. Again, we're speaking with Evan De Lucia at the U of I about some research he had that just came out about excessive rainfall, and also with Joe Zumwalt, whose farm's near Warsaw, Illinois, in Hancock County. We'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Into the 21st, I'm Myla Boodoo. We've been talking ag with farmer Joe Zumwalt. He farms about 4,000 acres of corn and soybeans just along the Mississippi River, of course, on our side of the border in Illinois. And we're also speaking with the researcher Evan De Lucia, and he's been doing some research about farmers thinking of drought as their worst enemy. But Evan, your study shows that too much rain can be just as harmful. And how are we thinking about how excessive rainfall can affect a crop like corn?
Yeah, this is a little bit of a different perspective than the challenges Joe's facing with flooding from overcoming levees and river flooding. You know, we've been just wet here in Illinois in Champaign County for the last couple of weeks, and what we're seeing in the field is a lot of ponding, a lot of flooding in fields that are not associated with rivers. And what this study did, this was under the leadership of a fella in natural resources, Caillou Guan. What this study did was to look at data on crop yields, but also insurance claims from farmers, and kind of take a statistical approach to see, okay, what's really knocking yields down? And the unique thing about this study and its message is that excessive rain is basically as bad as drought. And we're finding now that as the climate system ramps up, as it warms up, we're seeing more extremes, and we're seeing that very vividly here in central Illinois. More wet periods in the spring, longer periods of dryness in the summertime.
And so how are you seeing this affecting yields and crop and crops like corn in particular, Evan?
Sure, and there are a number of challenges. And one challenge, I was impressed that Joe's got most of his crop in the ground. Farmers in our county are really struggling to get into the fields to work because they're too wet.
So that's one problem then, right? So you can't even get in to plant early, right?
You can't even get in. And then when you can get in, it puts a real demand on the equipment. The implement guys who are providing spreaders and sprayers, you know, everybody needs them all at once. So that's one challenge. But particularly when the crop starts to emerge, it's very susceptible to basically drowning. I mean, there's just not enough oxygen in the soil. The roots wither and shrink. The plant can die. So it's a real challenge if the fields stay completely flooded for too long.
Joe, does that sound familiar? Have you faced any of this?
Yes, we certainly have. I mean, he's absolutely right. On wet seasons like this, you face the challenge of getting into the field. And then you face the agronomic challenges of basically that soil kind of becoming anaerobic because it's so saturated that you don't get any air into that seed as well. And so we are seeing that more and more. And one thing I might add to that, if you look back 40 or 50 years ago, we were planting corn and soybeans a little later in the season. I'd say, you know, most individual farmers didn't start till May, in some cases June, if you look at old wives' tales and follow the farmer's almanac. And we are pushing planting dates a little bit. We've learned that we have, in normal years, increased yields by earlier plantings. And so we are, in our area, you know, we're right in the prime time of corn planting, but we are definitely seeing these wet patterns that make it more difficult to get a crop in a timely manner.
So, Evan, I wonder, when you're trying to measure flooding compared to drought, is this something that's more difficult to measure?
Well, it's not really. There are a number of tools that we can use, including satellite imagery, to look at flooding. You know, one of the challenges right now is as the climate system continues to get energized. So we're warming the climate system, and that's driving extremes. And so we're living that now, and that we're seeing more intense precip early in the season. And we're seeing longer periods of drought later in the season. And one thing this study doesn't address that's kind of interesting and a little bit scary is one of the symptoms of a corn plant that's experiencing flooding is it doesn't produce a very good root system. And so you can imagine then that as that plant moves into a later season where it gets drier, it would be poised for even greater losses.
Mm.
So I'm afraid we're heading to more of a double whammy on our cropping systems.
And what more, Evan, what more research would you like to see done in this area then?
Well, excessive precip has not given the attention in terms of a crop breeding program that drought has. And so we need to really kind of look at the whole picture of what our crops are going to be facing in the future and think about new kinds of breeding programs to help farmers like Joe get the right kind of crop in the ground at the right time.
Joe, I was going to ask you that and end by asking that, like what you need, what you would like to see more research on as a farmer.
Yeah, what your comments, they're absolutely right. In the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, our genetic companies and seed breeders, one of the items or issues that they've been trying to focus on has been that of drought tolerance. And, you know, they've made great strides in drought-tolerant varieties of corn and soybean. On the other side of that, there's a limited amount you can do for making a specific hybrid or soybean or corn, either wheat for that matter as well, susceptible to the flooding conditions and the excessive moisture conditions, because we've made some good strides when it comes to seed treatments and things like that. Those have really helped us in these wet times, the new seed treatments that have come onto the marketplace in the last 5 or 10 years. But just to go back and highlight, there has been far more emphasis on drought tolerance than moisture tolerance.
Mm, right. And Evan, I wonder to that point, I mean, I'm thinking about how, for example, we've seen seeds of strains of rice and the modifications that have happened for floods. And we're thinking of Bangladesh and those areas. Do you maybe think that's another growing area of research to think to Joe's point about maybe more flooding, kind of more crops that can handle floods better, I guess?
Yeah, and so the challenge here is we can learn from the genetic traits of other crops that are successful in this kind of environment, but this is really special because it's not just flooding or just drought; it's
right.
Flooding then drought, right? So that's a tall order. So we might look at traits like very rapid emergence and elongation, so that the crop gets up fast and gets a root system, so it's a little more tolerant to that flooding. So there are a whole host of traits we might start looking at, but it really is kind of a new challenge for us.
Evan De Lucia has been looking into this and more at the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment at the University of Illinois, where he's also a professor of integrative biology. I want to thank Joe Zumwalt for being with us as well. He farms in Hancock County near Warsaw, Illinois. Joe, Evan, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure talking to you, Nyla.
All right, we were just talking about satellite data. We're going to end today's program talking a little bit more about that. And that's actually about, and it's actually more about an incredibly successful citizen scientist project that involves birders. More than 400,000 birders around the world are contributing to a project that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has been working on. They take the sightings of these bird watchers, mesh that with satellite photos and wildlife data, and the result is incredibly precise maps about specific bird species migrations, which can be used by everyone from farmers to cities, knowing when to dim their night lights. We've talked about that on the 21st before. Anders Gyllenhaal just wrote about this for the Washington Post. He's a veteran journalist who I had the pleasure of once working for. He's now running the website flyinglessons.us, where he writes about what we can learn from the avian world. And he's actually out birding right now on the eastern shore of Maryland, where he's joining us from. Hi, Anders. Welcome to the 21st.
Yes. Good morning, Nyla. It's nice to talk with you.
So for people who aren't birders, I wonder if we can start by just understanding, if we think about where we're situated in Illinois, how common is it for birds to be migrating through our part of the world depending on the time of year.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's very common. I mean, birds are everywhere, but it so happens they particularly are prevalent in Illinois. It's part of the Mississippi Flyway, which is the busiest in the U.S. And altogether, across the country, there are 4 to 5 billion birds that are migrating this time of year. And we're reaching the height right now in May. So you will have all kinds of birds coming through there on their way north.
So what kind of information are birders reporting to eBirds for this study?
Yeah, so birders, you know, need information. They need to know where is the best places to go, what am I likely to see so I can be prepared for that. What eBird does, which is basically, as you said, a citizen science project that also shares information among birders, it keeps track of everything anyone sees, and it tells you where the best places to go. So in many ways, it's serving the birder through its apps and also a website at eBird.org. But you can download an app and carry it with you wherever you go and keep track of what birds you're likely to see. And then you record what you see, if you're willing, and there's, as you said, hundreds of thousands of birders who do this, sort of an exchange, you get something for what you give. You record those sightings, and eBird, the Cornell lab, collects all that and puts it together to provide a blueprint for where all birds are and where they're going.
And how would this information be helpful, for example, for farmers in California can use this information, right?
Yeah, so what we wrote about in this piece that ran yesterday was how, and it's a little bit different farming base, I believe, in California, where they have a lot of rice farmers. A lot of these fields need to be flooded, unlike what you were just talking about. So the farmers have a choice of how long they keep their fields flooded. What eBird was able to do was say, if you were to flood your fields a little bit longer as different species are coming through, we can provide a place for these birds to stop, refuel, and keep going that has mostly evaporated from the Central Valley in California, where this experiment went on. And it's been very successful in providing a place for birds to in effect, get energy to keep their flights going.
And
the map,
yeah. No, go ahead. You were saying, what about the map?
The maps become very precise. So they take all of these sightings and they can extrapolate, well, what species are going to be where? And that's the real key to the Citizen Science Project. Can we say when birds are coming through, which species are coming through when, and can we help them in, you know, whatever way might be possible? When it was farming in California, they flooded the fields. You mentioned the whole issue of light pollution for birds. So birds are attracted to light, city lights, just like moths are to your porch bulb. And millions of birds get drawn into these cities, and it's a dangerous place for them to be. And Chicago was listed in a recent study. I think you may have mentioned this.
Yeah, Chicago's, we're unfortunately the worst, right? We're kind of the deadliest in the country.
Top of the list, and that's because it's a very busy flyway. They come right through the city, and there's a lot of light. So it's that combination. So the question is, you're not going to be able to get the city to turn its lights off. But what you can say, is it possible for the strongest lights in a city to tone them down a little bit for, say, 2 weeks during the height of the migration? These ideas are just now being brought up and being pursued by Cornell and other birding associations to see, you know, how can we apply this data to these kind of concrete remedies to protect birds.
So if folks want to help, this weekend is actually Global Big Day, right, Anders? Can you explain a little bit more about
that?
That's
right. So a couple of times a year, the various birding associations have day-long counts. And what that does is it gives you sort of an instant photograph of how many birds are seen where at one time, and then you can compare them from one year to the next. So this is Cornell's Global Big Day. It's very simple. Birders, you don't have to be an expert. You don't even have to be, you know, a full-time dedicated birder. You just get the app called eBird, and you file what you've seen for however long you want to go out. You know, it's a 24-hour count. The extremist will be out for 24 hours, I guess.
Are you going to be out for 24 hours?
I am not going to be out for 24 hours, but we'll try. We'll give a good shot. And then you're contributing something. I think that's part of the appeal of this whole project is that, 40% of the species on Earth are in decline. is one way to put it. There's different grades of trouble, endangered, threatened, generally in decline. So, you know, the changes in habitat, the changes in climate are having a dramatic impact on birds. And we are not, as you can see from the news, we're not going to address the climate issue anytime soon. But what you can do, the thinking goes, is help to adjust, to provide habitat where it's needed most, to turn down some of the hazards that are out there, to try to protect a species, particularly species that are in trouble. And, you know, birds, if I may go on a little longer here, you know, they are a barometer in our world. They tell us so many different things. And you know, everything from just how to be quiet and listen to nature to, you know, what's happening with the environment and what is its impact on these creatures that we share the world with. And so following them and trying to do our best to protect them has a lot of appeal for a lot of people.
Sure. And so if you want more information on this, we'll tweet it out. We'll have it at our website as well. Anders Gyllenhaal and his story he wrote for The Washington Post, if you want to learn more about this. Flyinglessons.us. Anders, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Nyla. We'll talk to you later.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about ProPublica recently did some reporting on a feature of TurboTax system that has lower income Americans paying for something they're actually entitled to use for free. You can go to 21stshow.org for more information about us, past shows. If you want to leave us some feedback, just go to 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.